In September of 1958, Archbishop Makarios made a statement in which he said, "I would be prepared to accept the status of independence for Cyprus on the condition that this status shall not be changed, either by union with Greece, by partition, or by any other way, unless the United Nations approves such a change."
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the American Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the American Centrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Throughout this series, we've explored a wide variety of perspectives about the Declaration of Independence. We've looked at female perspectives, Black perspectives, Native American perspectives. And we've also looked at the influence of the American Declaration on different countries, from Ireland to Mexico, and from France to the Netherlands. By using this comparative approach, we've learned that the Declaration was influential in some ways that we haven't realized. And at the same time, we discovered that it was not as influential as we often assume it to be. Nevertheless, the comparative approach always offers up some fresh insights, and today we're going to do some more comparative history by focusing on the island of Cyprus and its struggle for independence from the British Empire, which indeed finally occurred in 1960, roughly 200 years after the American Declaration. The obvious similarity between American and Cypriot independence is that both sought some form of independence from British rule. Also, within both societies, there was a wide variety of opinions about what their relationship with Britain should be like. In the American colonies, there were loyalists who wanted to remain British subjects. There were moderates who wanted an Irish model, which meant a restoration of their rights within a British imperial system. And of course, there were also extremists, the Sons of Liberty, who advocated absolute independence from Britain and who committed violence, not only against their fellow Americans, but Britons too, in order to achieve those ends. In this respect, American history has some interesting similarities with Cypriot history. As with the colonies, there was a similarly complex mosaic of political opinion in Cyprus. There were those who preferred enosis, an important word. Enosis was independence from Britain with union with Greece. So enosis, independence from Britain and union with Greece. There were also those who preferred total independence from Britain as well as independence from Greece. And there was also, like the Sons of Liberty, a militant group, AOKA, who pursued a campaign of violence against both the British and also Greek Cypriots who disagreed with them. And don't forget that Cyprus has a large Turkish Cypriot population, and they had their own concerns about British rule as well. They also were concerned about enosis with Greece, Cypriot independence, and their own relationship with Turkey. Many Turkish Cypriots supported Taksim, or partition, and some of them formed the Turkish Resistance Movement, the TMT. And in this respect, Turkish Cypriots are similar to the Catholic French Canadians who refused to join the primarily Protestant Anglo-American Revolution. And as a result, Canada remains within the British Commonwealth to this day. And don't forget that after declaring independence, the 13 colonies in America, one of the first things they did was to authorize the invasion of Canada, which had refused to join those 13 colonies. So we will start seeing some similarities with Cyprus here, too. Of course, after the Americans invaded Canada, then the British forces in Quebec invaded the new 13 colonies, the new United States. So there was plenty of war after independence in the United States. Now, the same can be said of Cyprus. Since the end of British rule in 1960 and the invasion of Turkey in 1974, the island of Cyprus consists of the Republic of Cyprus in the south, which is a member of the European Union and recognized by the United Nations, and then in the north, the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, which is a country only recognized by Turkey and considered to be an occupied territory by the rest of the world. While the United States, after the revolution, slowly consolidated its control over most of North America, and has settled borders. The island of Cyprus is still a contested space. It remains, to this day, a divided island with a divided capital and a militarized border monitored by the United Nations. Perhaps you already get a sense of the enormous complexity of the island of Cyprus, so today we're going to unpack the modern political history of Cyprus. By learning more about Cypriot history, I hope we will get some insight into American history as well. And it is my honor to have a world expert on Cypriot history here with me today, Professor Andrekos Varnava. Welcome, Andrekos.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be with you.
It's great that you're here. Kalispera.
Kalispera.
Andrekos is professor of history at the University of Flinders in Adelaide, Australia. He has written extensively about Cyprus and is the author of 4 books on Cypriot history, including Assassination in Colonial Cyprus in 1934 and the Origins of AOKA, British Cyprus in the Long Great War, 1914 to 1925, Serving the Empire in the Great War, The Cypriot Mule Corps, Imperial Loyalty and Silenced Memory, and lastly, British Imperialism in Cyprus, 1878 to 1915, The Inconsequential Possession. Okay, links for all of his books are in the show notes. All right, we're going to get started. I apologize for the long intro, but soon we're just going to be focused on Cyprus. Cypriot history goes back thousands of years. The island of Cyprus, due to its strategic position in the Mediterranean, has been coveted by so many different empires, it's kind of hard to go through the list. I created a short list, and I'm sure I'm missing some. But these are the different occupying forces in Cypriot history. Egyptians, Mycenaeans, Phoenicians, ancient Greeks, Persians, the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, Crusaders, Venetians, Ottomans, Britain, and Turkey, and I think that's most of them. All right? We're not going to explore all of these occupations. I need a place to start. So I'm going to start in 1776, which is when, in fact, the American Declaration was founded. So just a grouping of questions here, Andrekos. Did anyone in Cyprus pay attention to the fact that halfway across the world, some American colonists declared independence? And I'm asking this just because I'm interested. We need a place to start. But of course, we know that Greece is the cradle of democracy for Western civilization. So did the Cypriots in 1776 have some sense of those ancient Greek democratic ideals, which we see sort of passed then through the Enlightenment values of the American founding fathers? In other words, did they believe in democracy, that all men are created equal, that people have rights, and that political power only comes from consent?
Well, not in 1776. I mean, Cyprus was an Ottoman province. Greece didn't exist either in 1776 as a state. Obviously, that's about 55 years away, right? And Cyprus was part of the Ottoman Empire at the time. I would classify it in 1776 as probably being a backwater of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire did not do a whole lot in Cyprus or with Cyprus. And in 1776, it was during a time when the Cypriot Orthodox Church had become quite powerful, a powerful arm of the Ottoman administration. During this period, we're essentially seeing instability generated from below, really, because of things like poor harvest, too much tax. So there were revolts in the island, but the vast majority of the population were peasants. And both Christians and Muslims would have been involved in many of these revolts. Sometimes they did receive support from the elites, if you like, against the administration, but not usually, but often they were also against these revolts. But as for the American War of Independence, I doubt very much that it would have registered in any great capacity in Cyprus at the time.
What about some of these ideals, though, that when we look back at the American Declaration, this idea that government comes from the consent of the people, or that every, at least property in mail should have some say in how the community, the state is governed. Like, is any of that, these Enlightenment ideas, are they filtering through at all, or is it really, is that too much Western, and Cyprus is still an Eastern Ottoman type place?
Definitely Cyprus is Eastern Ottoman type. Even when the Greek War of Independence comes around in the 1820s, and the Archbishop at the time, Kyprianos, was visited by members of the Filigieteria, the Friendly Society, and they say to him, look, you know, can we spread the revolt to Cyprus? What can Cyprus do? Can you contribute? He says, I'm out. We're out. We're staying out of this. We do not want to bring the sky falling onto our heads. In the end, it didn't help him because he was executed as part of the governor's desire to reduce the power of the church. But there were no real threats in Cyprus at the time. The Orthodox Church in Cyprus was quite happy to be empowered within the Ottoman system. Well, there was no real move in any direction towards democracy.
Interesting. I just want to point out to our audience now that the role of the Orthodox Church is sort of central to Cypriot history, and we'll be hearing a lot about it. And for an American audience, I think it's hard for us to understand the great influence of a formal church could have over a nation, because we sort of went down the let's separate religion and government.
That's right.
But in Cyprus, we'll see that's not the case. A final question I have on this period around 1776. Was there ever a sense amongst Turkish or Greek Cypriots at the time that the island of Cyprus could and should just be independent? Or was that not even conceivable?
It wasn't conceivable in 1776. That's definitely for sure. You know, it wasn't really conceivable. When was it ever conceivable? You know, there were people who did suggest independence from time to time before the 1950s. But yeah, we'll come back to that, I assume, in our later discussions. But certainly not in the 18th century or even in the 19th century.
Okay, good. So we are going to come back to that. And again, Cypriot history is very complex and we're racing through a lot of time. But we do want to get to the next sort of key point, which is British rule. So just as quickly as possible, you said the Ottomans were in control of Cyprus in 1776. How do we get that from that period to British rule?
Yeah, so around 100 years later, actually, in 1878, the Ottomans had just lost the war with the Russians. The Russians were imposing a very tough peace that would have changed the strategic dynamics in the Balkans and to some extent in the Caucasus as well. The British weren't happy about that. Well, the British government at the time, Lord Beaconsfield or Benjamin Disraeli was the prime minister. He wasn't happy about this. And his government decided to refer to the Treaty of Paris, which had ended the Crimean War, which said that any revision of the Ottoman territory was for the joint agreement of the great powers. So once this was, so to speak, accepted, they were heading towards a Congress in Berlin. And prior to that, the British government negotiated, might be not the right word, but more or less forced the Sultan to accept a deal in which the British would agree to come to the aid of the Ottomans in a future war against Russia on the condition that it grants it the right to occupy and administer Cyprus with a view to establishing it as a base, a naval base, an army base. What followed from this was that once the British went to Cyprus, and this is the subject of my first book, which you mentioned before, British Imperialism in Cyprus, The Inconsequential Possession. When they got there, they realized that this is not a great place to have a base. I mentioned before Ottoman backwater. They didn't quite understand how much of a backwater Cyprus was. It didn't have any roads to speak of. It didn't have the harbour that they were hoping for. Or when they took a look at the harbour at Famagusta, they realised that they needed to spend money to make it worth using. And even though it actually wouldn't have cost a great deal of money to at least, you know, implement a first stage of renovating the harbour, they decided to go ahead. The place was very, very hot, stiflingly hot, and there began to be controversies about the health of the troops, and things just went from bad to worse in terms of the stories coming out of Cyprus until the government decided that it wasn't going to pay to make Cyprus a base, basically. And then, of course, not that long thereafter, a liberal government under William Gladstone occupied Egypt, even though that occupation was meant to be temporary, and for many, many years it was referred to as such. They, of course, stayed on and made use of the what we might call the Grand Harbour of Alexandria. And, of course, the other point to make is that the British already had one of the great harbours in the Mediterranean under their control. If you've ever been to Malta, you cannot deny the extraordinary harbour of Valletta and its entire protection from all sides, whereas Famagusta, which was the only place in Cyprus where you could have any type of enclosed harbour, is actually relatively open by comparison, certainly to Valletta.
I'm already getting a sense that British rule in Cyprus is nothing like the state of the 13 colonies in the United States. What we have in the 13 colonies in the United States are British and European colonists coming, booting out the native people and saying, this is now ours, but we're modeled, we are British subjects, we are British citizens, we have rights, right? We are going to have our own legislatures here. We swear allegiance to king and parliament, but we have local control. We have our own judiciary. We have our own militias. We're pretty independent, but we consider ourselves to have political rights. And I'm sensing this is not the state of the population of Cyprus. Yeah, so I guess the question that I want to ask here is, like, how does the British government conceive of the rights of a Cypriot person? They're not British subjects. Do they have any legal protections? I mean, how is any of this governance working?
Well, it is a bit unusual until 1925, when Cyprus does become a crown colony and then they become British subjects. However, until that time, Cyprus goes through several sort of phases in their status. But in terms of the rights of Cypriots, when the Liberal government does come to power in 1880, in 1882, it announces that Cyprus is going to get a legislative council. Now, what's quite interesting about this legislative council is that it basically gave a local majority to the Cypriots. However, if there was a deadlock in the council, the High Commissioner had the deciding vote. Now, the way that the numbers worked out in terms of the demographics, it was based on the demographics, it worked out that the elected members, who were all locals, then you had your nominated members, who were all British. If you added your British members and your Muslim members, and then you added the deciding vote of the High Commissioner, they could outvote the non-Muslim members, as they were referred to. In other words, the Greek Cypriots, although there was a time also when some Maronites were elected, but that's another story. Basically, there's this idea that the British instituted divide and rule right from the beginning. There isn't any evidence to suggest any of that. In fact, in the early 1880s, when the Liberals came to power, they rejected a proposal from the High Commissioner that the English language should be introduced into schools alongside the local languages. There was no plan to remove them. It was just to introduce English. And the colonial secretary at the time, Lord Kimberley, said that, well, why do we need to introduce English? Greek is a European language. So I've always had this feeling that, you know, an opportunity was sort of missed then that would have brought the English and the Cypriots a little closer together. But that just went to show how much respect, particularly Philhellenic liberal Britain, if you like, had for Greece and Greek being Greek, and also linking Cyprus to that. So even though Cyprus was, if you like, part of the British Empire, wasn't a crown colony at the time, but still part of the British Empire, even though under Ottoman sovereignty, that they were considering the Greek Cypriots as part of that wider Greek family.
At the same time, do you think that the mere presence of British governors, soldiers, etc., started slowly introducing some concepts, some of these say Anglo-American concepts of constitutional rights or Enlightenment ideas? So now, and then tying them back to ancient Greece and their ancient heritage?
Well, absolutely. The Legislative Council was actually one of the more democratic colonial institutions at the time when it was introduced in 1882. Malta had been part of the British Empire for most of that century, right, from the Napoleonic time, and yet it did not have such what we might call a liberal legislative council. It did not have one in which there was a local majority. The Legislative Council was the primary institution in which Cypriots were introduced to democratic processes and constitutional rule. Unfortunately, the British did not develop the council or really the constitution beyond the model of 1882. Even after Cyprus became a crown colony in 1925, you know, they would increase the number of members, but then they would also increase the members who were not elected, the British members. And so they would always manage to keep the numbers in which the High Commissioner or later the Governor would have a deciding vote. Until such time as in 1931, the Cypriots at the time were beginning to suffer from the Great Depression. By 1931, the British had made substantial progress in the development of Cyprus in certain areas, such as agriculture, public health, infrastructure, particularly communications, both internally and externally. You know, the harbors were much better and so forth. But the Great Depression started to hit Cyprus, and there were riots and what we might call food riots, and peasants destroyed warehouses or mills or whatever it might have been. And then by this point in time, the nationalist movement was not strong, but it was there and had its very strong idea of Cyprus wanting to unite with Greece. And it attempted to capitalize on this opposition and discontent around the Great Depression, and organized the demonstration in which the government house in Nicosia was burnt to the ground. Basically, it led to the suspension of the Legislative Council and the Constitution.
Andreikos, before we get to the burning of the government house, I just want to get a stronger sense of what it was like to be a Cypriot imperial subject, and then like kind of a better British subject once it officially becomes a crown colony.
Okay.
So you mentioned like this Legislative Council.
Mm.
I know an Irish historian will yell at me. It sort of sounds like the Irish model, where the British are like, okay, well, we'll have some local rule there, but at the end of the day, Parliament can override anything they don't like. You know?
Yep.
Okay, fine. But the other thing I just kind of wanted to focus a little bit on was the judiciary, which I think is really interesting. To what extent is Britain introducing more of a British model of laws and a system of justice and a legal system that also is kind of introducing concepts, then generally speaking, of political freedom and the rights of man, very much all men are created equal stuff from the U.S. Declaration of Independence, and sort of inserting that ideologically into the Cypriot population.
When in the early decades of British rule, the British basically did not make substantial changes to the Ottoman way of doing things or to Ottoman laws. They did tweak what we might, I think it's fair to say they tweaked things. They made the judiciary fairer in certain respects. For example, you know, they did away with Ottoman system of not allowing a Christian to testify against a Muslim, for example. But the judiciary itself does not really begin to take on a British face until much later on. And really until Cyprus is annexed by the British in 1914, we're really talking about a British facade on top of an Ottoman sort of face, if you like. Yes, a lot of laws are introduced, but they are done through modifying previous Ottoman laws or introducing new laws that may never have been there for whatever reason, but adopting a sort of Ottoman style of doing it with a sort of composite British facade, really. It's not until much later on, like I said, that it begins to change, but it never totally changes.
Okay, and then so you mentioned 1925 a couple of times, and this is pivotal in the development of the story. Again, we're going to get to the burning of Government House in 1931, sure. But first I want to do this 1925. So 1925, Cyprus becomes a British crown colony, which sort of enhances the status of your average Cypriot.
Sure.
Now a Cypriot can like move to London, as many did, right? Yeah. And have like work rights and residency rights and all of this. Is this one of the advantages of becoming a crown colony?
Yeah, I mean, technically they could have moved before this as well. So until 1925, Cypriots were given a sort of anomalous status in which they were protected by the British if they went overseas, except within the Ottoman Empire, although there were instances on which Cypriots did appeal for Ottoman protection within the Ottoman Empire. But the status was obviously totally unsatisfactory. It caused a lot of problems for Cypriots overseas. You know, what is this weird status here that, you know... So really 1925 did put an end to all of that confusion and did allow Cypriots to, move more freely. In terms of migration, Cypriots did begin to look to migrate overseas just before World War I. It was only sort of a small wave of this, you know, movement. There were quite a few who went to the Americas, broadly speaking, because I'm including Latin America in this as well as North America. World War I ended, put an end to that because the British wanted to establish a mule corps to be sent to the Macedonian front. So they basically stopped Cypriots who were of, you know, the right age, so to speak, from migrating to facilitate this recruitment. And then after World War I ends, Cypriots once again begin to look to move. But you're right, it's really not until the end, the late 1920s, that Cypriots are moving in larger numbers to the UK and to a lesser extent Australia. In America, there are already restrictions and quotas by this point. Australia begins to restrict Cypriots as well. What the UK does is it makes it harder for Cypriots to go there. It makes them sort of jump through a few other hurdles before they can, but doesn't have the same type of restrictions as the United States or Australia.
Well, and one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about the emigrating to Britain and particularly London, because there's a very big, even at this time, Cypriot population in London. And I'm trying to trace where some of these concepts of the modern Republic of Cyprus, I'm thinking that as Cypriot men primarily are moving to London, they're in an environment where, again, they're getting lots of ideas, Western, yes. European, Anglo-American yes. ideas about constitutions, yes. Western types of judiciaries. Yes. And they're not just keeping those in London, right? This is another route that ideologically sort of Ottoman influence then is being reduced because these people are writing back and going back to Cyprus and being like, hey, why are we fighting for the British when we don't have rights? You know, we're British subjects and now we have to fight in World War One and World War Two. Well, it's a lot of these London Cypriots who are kind of bringing these ideas of, you know, the rights of all men are created equal. We should only be governed if we consent to those who are governing us. We are not beneath anything else. We ought to have some form of self-government. And that's coming again through the immigration through London, yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, the number of Cypriots to the UK really takes off in 1929. Throughout the 30s, it's very high and continues to be so after World War II. In the 30s, there's a very strong communist element. Cypriots involved in the Communist Party of Great Britain. And there is a strong strain there of self-government and self-determination as well. And eventually it comes very strongly under the control of AKEL, which is formed in 1942 to replace the previous Communist Party in Cyprus. The first Communist Party of Cyprus was opposed to Enosis. AKEL, however, was in favor of Enosis. Initially, it supported self-government, a return to constitutional rule, which, as I said, had been suspended in 1931. But then later in the 1940s, in the late 1940s, it adopted the position of the right wing, which was immediate Enosis. You know, the right wing called it Enosis and only Enosis. AKEL called it immediate Enosis. There was no real difference, however. But in terms of London Cypriots, there were others who had a different position. And you might know of my article, Revisiting the Road to Cypriot Independence, where I introduce a guy who was really, in many respects, lost to history, Jason Lukianu, who basically was, if you like, a liberal and probably supported the Liberal Party in the UK. Certainly had links to the Liberal Party in the UK. And he is exactly what you're describing in the sense that he wanted to Cyprus to become independent. He believed that its future lay in the Greek and Turkish Cypriots creating this independent state. So he was probably one of the only ones who expressed these views openly and to in official circles and making proposals even to the British during the mid-1950s and even having influence in relation to Makarios even in 1958. But independence was not favored by the Greek Cypriot political elites.
The story of Jason Lukianu, I think, is so interesting because when I look at all the constellation of players involved in the politics in Cyprus at the time, the one that I read about, and I was like, he sounds like the most American.
Yes.
In his political ideals, we don't have to be sort of governed by our religious backgrounds. We can be independent. We can have some sort of Anglo-American model of the rule of law, a constitution. I'm like, this guy is the one that, for me, seems like he's the most influenced by the same political ideas that influenced the American founders. But I'll let you comment on that later because I just want you to do a quick summary now of basically the main grievances that these three different, broadly speaking, three different types of Cypriots have against being under the British. And these all culminate first in this burning of Government House, which we've mentioned a couple of times. But like we've got the Enosis Cypriots who want independence, but then joining with Greece. Then we have the Taksim, maybe the Turks, who want to be separate. And then we have the Jason Lukianu types who want some sort of liberal American style. Don't yell at me, American style. Cyprus.
Okay, so I mean, by 1931, the idea or demand for Enosis, it wasn't just represented by one group. There were numerous groups. There were, if you like, a traditional moderate group that believed that the best way to reach it or to achieve it was to work with the British and be friendly and allow them to eventually grant the union of Cyprus with Greece. But by 1931, there is a far more militant Enosis group that has formed. It formed in 1929. The National Radical Union of Cyprus, which was armed. It had arms. We know that it had arms. It was very much inspired by the rise of fascism and later on Nazism. And it was willing to use weapons and violence against Cypriots and against the British to achieve their demand. The majority of its leadership were expelled from the island after the 1931 burning of Government House because they had been implicated in not just that, but also other attacks on government properties and infrastructure. And, you know, its leaders, and now I'm going to come to those who had really moderate views, if you like, more like the Jason Lukianu types. The leadership of this radical group established itself in Athens. It still had its supporters back in Cyprus, some of whom had also been, you know, sent into what we might call internal exile to remote parts of Cyprus, you know, where they couldn't cause any trouble. But by 1933-34, they've been released. In 1933, what the British do is they announce that they're going to have an advisory council. So this advisory council would have not many, but some Cypriots who would be part of it and provide advice to the government. Now, this was the first step that the British wanted to take and see how it works, if it works, to then move towards introducing a new constitution. What I should have said, and I haven't said, is that there also existed an executive council on which there were Cypriots as well represented. But this advisory council was something in addition to the executive council. Anyway, the advisory council was announced at the end of 1933, and the British knew that they wanted, right from the very beginning, one person to be on it for sure. And that was a guy called Antonios Triandafilidis. Now, Triandafilidis was a leading lawyer. He had been a nationalist and he was pro-Enosis. He was pro-union of Cyprus with Greece. But he was, I would say, appalled by the events of 1931. To him, I think
appalled by the violence.
Yes, appalled by the violence of 1931.
Government House.
Yeah. And he just believed that this was the wrong way to go about achieving Enosis. He argued that he wanted Cyprus and Cypriots themselves to develop and to become more educated, the country to be more developed in different ways, economically, its public health, its agriculture, and so forth. And from that position, they would be in a much stronger place to advocate for union of Cyprus with Greece. The problem was that he got himself into some trouble by agreeing to be part of the advisory council. He is now considered a traitor by his former allies.
By the extremist group.
The extremist group, who he had once upon a time been supported by when he himself had won a seat on the legislative council. Now, He attended only one meeting of the advisory council before he was shot and killed. This is the subject of my last book, because the story was just so fascinating. It's a taboo subject, really, in Cyprus, this story, with all sorts of rumors going around that, oh, he was assassinated because he was a womanizer or because he was this or that. It's like, well, if he was a womanizer, then they would have assassinated quite a lot, many more than just one person. This was clearly political. The British knew it was political, and they linked it immediately to those who had been, sent to abroad. They were living in Athens, and their supporters in Cyprus. A guy was eventually charged, put on trial. There were witnesses, two or three from memory, that basically identified who were behind this, because the guy who was charged was merely being paid to do it. He wasn't, and all linking it back to this previously, the party, the National Radical Union of Cyprus. Now, the National Radical Union of Cyprus, some of its members who were still around in the early 1950s were behind the formation of EOKA. Hence the title of the book, the Origins of EOKA. So there was a clear line of continuity between those individuals, between the early group and the later one that we come to know in the 1950s. Now, the assassination of Triantafylidis was a tragedy for Cyprus, because he was potentially even more influential than somebody like Jason Lukianou later on, who was an influential Cypriot of the diaspora. But Triantafylidis was a very prominent Cypriot. I mean, everybody knew Triantafylidis. He was the number one lawyer in the country. Even one of the bishops, even though he didn't like Triantafylidis, when he got himself into some trouble with the British, he hired none other than Triantafylidis to represent him.
Yeah, I just kind of want to get back in this period, to get back a little bit into the British perspective of what's happening in Cyprus. Yeah. So, and I guess one question that has been sort of haunting me this entire time is specifically, and you've talked now about the Enosis group, the radical, violent Enosis groups, then Triantafylidis, who is a little bit more moderate, Jason Lukianou, whom I've described as the American, which is wrong. Yeah. But what we haven't really talked about is the Taksim group. And so what I would like you to do is just to talk a little bit about what's it like in this period between 1931, the burning of Government House, and like the next 10 or 15 years. Yeah, the Turkish Cypriot population, but also like from their perspective, but how throughout all of these years is the British government conceiving of the ethno-religious diversity of Cyprus?
Yeah. Let me start by saying that the Turkish position in respect to Enosis was always that it was opposed to it and something that it feared. It feared what had occurred in other parts of the Eastern Mediterranean, such as, say, in Crete or elsewhere. And later on, of course, there is the exchange of population between Greece and Turkey as a result of the Greeks call the Asia Minor catastrophe and the Turks call the Turkish War of Independence. But the point is that the Turkish Cypriots genuinely feared that potentially they could be expelled or be second-class citizens as part of Greece. Obviously, in Cyprus, they are, roughly speaking, a 20% demographic minority. But in a Greece, if that Cyprus is part of Greece, they'd be, what, a 1% minority? I mean, they know what, Now, Taksim was an idea that was not around until EOKA came about.
The Turkish Cypriots. Okay, so then I want to pause you right there. Sorry, Andreikos. It strikes me as fascinating that already at this point you're talking about the Turkish Cypriots as being fearful of being second-class citizens. So there's already a concept of like rights, and protections and this idea that all citizens should be equal. And again, I'm wondering where that's coming from. And of course, I'm taking it back to the American Revolution always.
Sure.
How does a Turkish Cypriot get the idea that I should have equal rights? I mean, that strikes me as being a very Western, European, Anglo-American Enlightenment concept.
Well, the concept of rights and whose say should, I suppose, determine the status of Cyprus basically grew out of Woodrow Wilson's self-determination, national self-determination. Which, of course, you could argue grows out of the American Revolution. But the difference being that for the Greek Cypriots, they argued that we're the majority, it's our say. So they had this concept of majoritarianism that wasn't based on political elections and parties and ideology, but purely based on ethnicity or ethno-religious identity, because, of course, in Cyprus, the two go hand in hand, really. Now, the Turkish Cypriots are reacting to this and saying, well, we need, as a minority, we need to be protected, and we have our own rights. We were, you know, part of the Ottoman Empire. So Turkey, which supposedly inherited the Ottoman Empire in some respects, although is a different country, supposedly secular, they still look to Turkey just like the Greek Cypriots are looking towards Greece. I mean, if the Greek Cypriots are looking towards Greece, why shouldn't the Turkish Cypriots look towards Turkey, is their sort of position? Just because they're a demographic minority, what does that matter? Now, however, their default, their first number one position is for the British to stay. So their concept of protection and their concept of, well, who can protect our rights is the British. They argue that only the British can keep the peace, so to speak, and keep the country from falling apart, which eventually actually becomes the British position as well, really. And that's how they go about preventing, you know, solutions earlier on, let's say in the 50s, and also how they hold on by basically saying we're needed here.
Right. So next question here, I want to get us the formation of AOKA, and you said this is connected then to the formation of the Turkish separatist concept of Taksim. So why don't you talk me through the creation of AOKA and the creation of Taksim, and then eventually get us to how we get to Cypriot independence.
Okay. So AOKA was formed actually in Athens by a group of far right-wing individuals, some of whom were connected to Cyprus and some of whom were part of the National Radical Union of Cyprus, which I mentioned earlier, had formed in 1929, and some of its members were exiled or whatever, expelled, and ended up in Greece. Some of them were still alive and were quite instrumental in the formation of AOKA in 1951, in which Makarios III, who became Archbishop of Cyprus in the late 1940s, in 1950, I should say, he became Archbishop. He was part of the formation of this organization, which was to use violence in order to achieve enosis. And they recruited a Cypriot who had lived for most of his life in Greece and was a Greek army officer. At the time, he was a colonel, Colonel George Grievous. And Grievous had been essentially a leader of a paramilitary group during the Second World War and during the Greek War of Independence. There were a lot of far right-wing individuals and groups during the German occupation. The Germans, however, they wanted to work with a certain set of people and certain type of person who was amenable to their, you know, what they wanted to do. Grievous was an individual, highly volatile figure. So even though he would have loved to have worked with the Germans, they didn't want to work with him. But towards the end of the occupation, there was a cooperation, and then he makes his name as well during the Greek Civil War. Did I say War of Independence? I meant Greek Civil War. But when he attempted to enter Greek politics after the Greek Civil War, it all went pear-shaped. So then he's looking for something, and this was the next thing. Go back to his homeland, if I can use that term. I don't know if he would have used that term, because he was so immersed in this idea of uniting Cyprus with Greece that his homeland was Greece, and he wanted Cyprus to be part of Greece. So he becomes the military leader of Eorka. Now, as for the British, very quickly, after the Second World War, Cyprus increasingly becomes more and more important as the years go on, because they're losing parts of their empire left, right, and center, and including in the Middle East. And particularly the big one, of course, is the, basically they're pushed out of their base in Egypt.
Yeah, so we're heading towards the Suez Crisis now.
Yeah. And so as early as 1952, the British have to make a call. They're going to have to evacuate their base there. So where are they going to put it? Cyprus. So this all is happening at the same time. It's the Greek Cypriots, they're steps behind, you know what I mean? Very bad time to be doing what they're planning to do. As for the Turkish Cypriots, it's very interesting. In the early, Eorka began its activities on the 1st of April of 1955. As I have mentioned or hinted, the core of Eorka were far-right wing Greeks and Greek Cypriots. Now, the Turkish Cypriots initially, their leadership initially argued that the British should stay and held with that line. But very quickly, that line became very anachronistic in this world of 1955. So they then began to look towards Turkey, because they realized that potentially the British cannot protect them anymore. So the protection that they need in their eyes is going to come from Turkey. Now, they're sort of helped in this regard, because the British invite Turkey to give their opinion on what's going on in Cyprus, for instance, at the London conference, in which Greece, Turkey, and the British are represented, but no Cypriots were represented. But the position of the Turkish Cypriot leadership basically very quickly becomes partition, or if you like, Taksim. And they also form their own Turkish Defense Force, TMT as it's known by its English translated and acronym. Basically, the British do, during this period, implement a what we might call a divide and rule strategy to hang on, arguing that, if they leave, it'll just leave a powder keg, it's just going to blow up.
For me, what's really interesting is the concept of rights, the rights of the Turkish Cypriots, the rights of the Greek Cypriots, the muddying the waters with the ethno-religious conflict, which really takes away this idea that everyone there ought to be politically equal, despite their ethnic or religious background. And Britain, which of course does have a unique and long political tradition and legal tradition of establishing this, but also their kind of imperial sense is conflicting with their sense of the rights of man, of the British subject, and they can't quite figure a way out of this. Right? Yeah. They're not strong enough to do it by force. As you said, they're getting kicked out of Egypt. And it's almost like, I always compare this now to the consequences of the British Empire's great successes in the Seven Years' War. They bit off more than they can chew. They won the war against the French, but then they got these 13 colonies who then decided to rebel.
Yeah.
It empowered these 13 colonies, rather they didn't get them, but it empowered the 13 colonies to say, now we want to be independent. And so sometimes the British Empire's successes turn into its final failures, and that's sort of what we're getting to here in Cyprus, and that they have a situation they can't manage, right?
Yeah, I mean, after the Second World War, the British offered Cyprus a constitution. By this point, however, although we're very early on in the Cold War, we need to remember that the Cold War, one of the first battlegrounds of the Cold War was Greece. with the Greek Civil War. What this means is that, and what occurs is that the Greek Civil War, although it doesn't spread to Cyprus, the politics of the Greek Civil War does spread to Cyprus. And even as early as, you know, the years 46, 47, we see members of, for example, Grievous's, as it was known, the HE organization in Cyprus operating, trying to manipulate, for instance, the election of an archbishop. There is a archbishop who only lasts around 40 days and he dies under very suspicious circumstances with numerous witnesses and individuals arguing that he did not die from a natural death. And very quickly we have an exiled bishop who had returned to Cyprus not that very long before, whom the British described as senile and was probably the mastermind of the assassination of Triandafylidis back in January of 34, suddenly elected as archbishop. So he's the one just before the younger Makarios, who replaces him when he dies. But for the British, the Cold War is in full swing, and they all of these previous people whom they had exiled in 31, whom they had linked to the assassination of Triandafylidis in 34, and so forth and so on. They allowed him to return and to take an active political life in Cyprus.
As a bulwark against communism, you're suggesting?
As a bulwark against communism, because Agel was highly successful in controlling the trade unions. That basically what we had in Cyprus and still do is we have Agel trade unions, and then we have the others. And Agel was always sometimes referred to as the old trade unions and the new trade unions, because the right wing wanted to have its own trade unions. And yeah, the British did not want Agel to prosper. They tried to, they banned it. They tried to stamp it out. All the while, the far right is the one that's preparing for this violence that breaks out in April of 1955. It was a monumental failure in intelligence from a British perspective.
Can you just describe what happens in 1955?
So EOKA begins its activities in April of 1955. Its plan is to attack British installations using sabotage, to attack British military and police personnel and also members of the administration, to attack Greek Cypriots who are members of the police, Turkish Cypriots as well, members of the police and security forces more generally, or people who are opposed to their views.
Do they accompany this with a declaration of independence in any respect, or they just do it?
No, they do put out a declaration, not of independence, but of union with Greece. And they refer
It's a declaration of Enosis, not independence.
Yes, declaration of Enosis and references to the Greek War of Independence and how, and also to, you know, the 300 Spartans and so forth and so on. So this long narrative of Greek successful military campaigns. And they draw upon the Greek War of Independence a lot in their propaganda. And yeah, basically unleash this violence. I mean, it's unusual because there is no other really example like it in terms of the colonial conflicts that emerge after the Second World War. I mean, the only thing that's anti-British about it is that the British are the ones who are holding Cyprus, and they want to remove them. There's no serious anti-colonial rhetoric or position. Their position had always been, their ideologues had always been opposed to independence, very deliberately and very openly. A key figure is Polycarpos Ioannidis, who goes back to the early 30s and goes back to the assassination of Triandafylidis as one of the key figures. But, you know, he was a very prolific journalist And he would consistently write that we are better under British control, colonial control. I mean, they didn't even have a constitution, so it's quite authoritarian. We are better off like this than having self-government, than having a constitution. So basically, they refused to have representative institutions. Why? Because, well, potentially through representative institutions, through working together with Greek and Turkish Cypriots, whether they're different ideologically or whether they're, you know, from a different ethno-religious group, potentially they might end up not wanting Enosis.
Yeah. I'm struck by the concept, again, that all of these, well, most of the varying political opinions in Cyprus, they're all quite scared of actually becoming what Cyprus is today.
That's right.
They're like they're petrified of being a republic. Like, because no, we want to be under the British. We'd rather be under the Turks or part of Greece. Heaven forbid we're actually a member of the European Union and a functioning democracy and constitutional republic. It's just, it's almost funny.
It's the accidental republic, or the reluctant republic, as one academic many years ago used as the title of his book.
And why don't you just quickly now, as we're getting to the end here, just talk me through those last phases until then, Cyprus becoming independent. So we are at the uprising of Aeoka in 1955, and Cyprus does become independent then in 1960, correct?
Yes.
So just can you briefly talk me through that period?
So very quickly, by 1958, the situation in Cyprus is a lot worse than what it was in 1955. The British had attempted to, on several occasions, to introduce a constitution, and it even had a constitution drawn up by Lord Radcliffe. Lord Radcliffe was the guy who drew the partition line of India. But simultaneously, they also were, from very early on, supporting the Turkish position, to the point where they also put on the table the possibility of partition. So this is in 1956, early 57. And then we also have the Suez crisis. And then we get to 1958, and the Prime Minister of Great Britain is now Harold Macmillan. And he puts forward this idea of a partnership plan. The partnership plan basically envisaged a period of self-government in Cyprus under a constitution which envisaged considerable protective rights for the Turkish Cypriots, and also envisaged both Greek and Turkish government representation. Now, the final sort of offer was that maybe one day Cyprus could become a tricondominium in which Britain, Greece, and Turkey would share sovereignty over Cyprus. Now, all of this for Makarios was beginning to be very worrisome. He had been exiled by the British in 1956 to the Seychelles Islands, where he was for about a year.
Sorry, I'm just going to interrupt once. We're starting to talk about Makarios, and this was the figure, just for so the audience remembers, that Andreikos read the quotation at the very start. Makarios, sometime considered to be the father of Cypriot independence, but Andreikos has an opinion on that. So this Makarios, who is an archbishop.
Yeah, and basically you mentioned before about the importance of the church. In Cyprus, the archbishop is not simply the head of the church, but also has the title of ethnarch. And although the role of ethnarch changed over time, and I did do a book many years ago about this, you know, moving from, you know, Ottoman, basically arm of the Ottoman government to, well, attempting to be an arm of the British government, and that didn't work, to becoming the figure, or the leading figure of the Enosis nationalist demand, and Makarios being dynamic, young, American educated, by the way. He studied theology in Boston. Nevertheless, a right-wing nationalist. However, by 1958, he's beginning to realize that the whole situation started by Aeoka is on the edge of a precipice. And he realizes that it's not working, and he needs to do something dramatic before the island potentially becomes partitioned. And so he makes a move by agreeing to meet with the president of the British Labour Party, who was a woman called Barbara Castle, who goes to Athens to meet him. And they have a series of discussions. I should point out that Makarios has also met with other people, including Jason Lukianou. So he has in his mind something. The idea of independence was not new. It was also discussed at the United Nations. The Indian representative was very supportive of an independent Cyprus and setting aside, you know, ethno-religious identities. Makarios decides that in order to stop partition, he agrees to independence and to set aside Enosis and partition.
Okay, so here we're getting now to September 1958, and this is where you started. This is where Makarios says, quote, "I would be prepared to accept the status of independence for Cyprus on the condition that this status shall not be changed either by union with Greece, by partition, or by any other way unless the United Nations approves such a change." And so you can just explain that now, because this is drawing together all of these different crazy strands of Cypriot history, and this is why this statement from Makarios is so important.
That's right, because basically the most important part of the statement is the very last one, because although people have primarily only focused on the first part, which is that he has now dramatically switched and changed to independence, independence is not for him the final solution. It's not the permanent solution, which it was for many others, including, of course, Jason Lukianou. Makarios says in that very last part, unless approved by the United Nations. So what occurs is that once Cyprus is independent, the agreements which were terribly complicated. However, this is how consociational systems of government and constitutions are. They're about power sharing, and they're about protecting the demographic minority. In this case, the Turkish Cypriots, according to the constitution, are politically an equal community with the Greek Cypriots, despite their demographic minority status. That's not what the constitution says. It doesn't refer to them as a minority in this sense. Anyway, by 1963, the constitution is not being properly implemented by the government. There are manufactured conflicts as a result of this or that. And meanwhile, both sides never gave up their arms totally. While EOKA under Grivas no longer exists, EOKA, however, it has splintered into different groups led by different individuals. However, there is also an official group led by the Minister of Interior, Poligarpos Yorkagis, who is involved very closely with radical elements in the Greek army. Now, in November of 1963, Makarios puts forward 13 proposals to amend the constitution. The majority of these changes were to water down Turkish Cypriot protections and rights. And before the Turkish Cypriots could respond, because they stated officially that they would respond in January, the Minister of Interior orchestrates a little event, a little clash, which then snowballs. And this leads to what essentially is a civil war between Greek and Turkish Cypriots that lasts until, on and off, it pretty much lasts until 1974. But in terms of that initial period, it goes up until about August of 1964. There's another round of violence in 1967. But, you know, you understand that little comment at the end in 1958, unless approved by the United Nations. The whole plan was to go to the United Nations, and by removing certain constitutional rights and also removing the treaties that prevented Cyprus from joining Greece, the government of Makarios was going to go to the United Nations and argue that for self-determination, meaning the majority Greek Cypriots, meaning Enosis. It all went pear-shaped again, however.
Mm-hmm. And it is where we are today. If one goes to Cyprus, one will be on a divided island with the Republic in the south, yep. That's the member of the EU, and then northern Turkish Cyprus, which is acknowledged by Turkey because of the Turkish invasion in 1974, which they argue was to protect Turkish Cypriots from Enosis,
yep.
That Makarios had planned. And we are now going to end it right here, and I will just have some final comments and allow you then to make a very final comment.
Yep.
This history of Cyprus is so fascinating, and of course it's unfair of me to always think about how this connects to American democracy and American history and the American Declaration of Independence. But for me, what really strikes me as being fascinating about the American democratic experience is, one, the fact that we have this Anglo concept of constitutional rights of citizens, subjects, but for whatever reason, all men are created equal and are equal before the law. But it's, and this is what really strikes me about Cypriot history. The second aspect of that is, even as far back as the 1770s, people like Thomas Jefferson were saying, what screws all this up is religion. Our system, the American system, can only work if we don't privilege in any governmental way one religion over another. And in his notes on the state of Virginia in the 1770s, as he was a delegate for the Virginia Commonwealth before the Declaration of Independence, they always already recognized, like, we can't, you know, religion can't be part of this, because that's just going to screw up all of this model we are having. And what you see about this thorny problem of Cyprus, it's the ethnic religious conflict that is preventing it from being solved. So my solution, of course, as an imperial American, is say they should just be more American and get over the religious differences. Okay. I ask all my guests in this series to reflect on the 250-year anniversary of the American Declaration of Independence, but maybe you can end, Andrekos, by actually looking into the future. Where do you think Cyprus will be in 2060, 100 years after independence?
Well, my mind says one thing and my heart says another. My mind says that there will be very little change from what we have today. You know, my heart says that I would love to see Cyprus have a go at being a bi-communal, bi-zonal federation, in which there are two constituent states and a central federal government. That would be my dream and hope, to set aside what has transpired, not to forget, but, you know, truth and reconciliation are going to be very important for any form of reunification. And hopefully it happens before 2060, but that would be my hope for 2060.
Thank you very much, Professor Andrekos Varnava.
Thanks, Andrew, for having me. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.